Okay, so I was just going to say one more word about baryogenesis, or make one more, you know, try to get across one more idea. And then the plan will be to spend most of this lecture talking about the homogeneous picture of inflation. And then next lecture, the one at 11:30, the inhomogeneous case. By which I mean everything in this lecture, all quantities will not depend on space. It will just be how the Friedman, Robertson, Walker solution and its matter content evolve and why. But then one of the most important consequences of that is that if you now give the matter that was driving the homogeneous evolution, if you quantize it and just ask what happens to the vacuum fluctuations of that matter, they get amplified into primordial density perturbations, which can be made in a rather impressive way to match the primordial density perturbations we actually see in the early universe, and that grew into the bigger density perturbations that you see in your own family reunions and that are in the universe today. I really feel we need a joke right at the start. Doesn't anybody else feel the lack? So nobody has a clean joke? Nothing? Dig deep. Something that starts like, you know, two peanuts walk into a bar, or like one potato says to the other potato, you know, why so many eyes or something like that? Nothing like that? No? I'm asking for your help. No shy person in the audience. You sure there's not a single shy person in the audience who actually knows a clean joke, but is too shy to say it? In which case, you could whisper it to me and I would tell it? Nobody. Preferably, it would be a short joke. I've probably taken up most of the joke time just asking for a joke. Okay, go.
What's green and invisible?
Genius. Thank you. I'm at peace. Okay. So, last time we said there's both theoretical and observational evidence that there were you know, at a one part in a billion level, more baryons than antibaryons in the early universe when the temperature was about 10 GeV. And the question is, what is the interpretation? In the past, one might have said, baryon number is strictly conserved in the standard model of particle physics. We've never seen a baryon, we've never seen a proton decay, and its stability is caused by baryon number conservation. So maybe this is telling us that, you know, apparently we're forced by that view, by interpretation one, to just say, well, the baryon asymmetry was put in the initial conditions. But Sakharov in the 60s made the prescient suggestion that another possibility is that the initial conditions were symmetric, and that it's the dynamical evolution of the universe that generated dynamical evolution of the early universe that generated a Berry anisymmetry. And at the time, that was probably dismissed as a wacky suggestion. Well, at the time, it didn't get a great deal of attention. Evidence accumulated that, so first of all, we learned in the mid-70s, Etouft realized that, in fact, non-perturbative quantum effects, even in the standard model of particle physics, do violate baryon number. Okay, but it turns out that that baryon number violation is so weak at the low temperatures where we live today that it's stupendously weak. So you expect, not a single proton in the Earth has decayed over the entire age of the universe due to this effect. Okay, so it's in principle it's there, but nevertheless it showed that in principle it was there, and then people realized that that's a very closely related effect. If you think about, okay, the effect is very weak at low temperatures, but of course the early universe was once hotter. And if the early universe was ever hotter than about the electroweak scale, in other words, when the universe was above the a temperature that corresponds to roughly roughly 300 GeV, then it turns out that a closely analogous effect, which goes under the name of a sphaleron, closely analogous non-perturbative effect, violates baryon number like crazy. Okay. And then furthermore, another thing that happened in the 70s was that the standard model of particle physics has this gauge group that is a product of factors, and people got the idea that the next step in unification should be to find another gauge theory that has a single gauge group that contains this guy as a subgroup. And the simplest theory they found like that was at SU5, and they found other theories like that. And those all had this property that they would have violated baryon number in the early universe effectively. So anyway, so Sakharov predicted it on other grounds, but these subsequent developments have kind of made his perspective the modern one. You know, most people today think this sort of answer is more likely than this sort of answer. Not to mention the fact that, as we will see later, this sort of answer is basically inconsistent with inflation, if inflation really did happen in the early universe. Okay, so then Sakharov said, well, in order for my picture of dynamical evolution creating the asymmetry to be correct, what conditions have to be satisfied? And on general grounds, he argued that there were the three Sakharov conditions. So the theory, whatever theory was created the asymmetry, must violate baryon number. It must violate both charge conjugation and charge conjugation combined with parity. And finally, it must violate thermal equilibrium. Okay, so the final thing I wanted to say about this is that just to give a sort of concrete, a slightly more concrete picture of an implementation of this idea in a sort of more concrete particle physics context, and see, you know, how these, it just gives another sort of more particle physics-y picture of where these three conditions enter the story. So so let's just imagine that we have some theory, some extension of the standard model that has a heavy particle called X, and it has two different ways that it can decay. Its decay is baryon number violating. In other words, one decay channel, it decays to, you know, some particles up here, and if you count up their total baryon number, it's B1. And if you, there's another way it can decay to a different set of particles. If you count up their total baryon number, it is B2. And let's say that the branching ratio, in other words, the fraction of decays that go this way is R, the fraction of decays that go this way is 1 minus R. Okay, so it just has these two decay channels. So So if that's the case, it's antiparticle. So a concrete example here is indeed in these grand unified theories there are these gauge bosons that after the grand unified theory is broken, spontaneously broken, and analogous to electroweak symmetry breaking, the grand unified theory is broken down to the subgroup that is the standard model group. Just like in electroweak symmetry breaking, some of those gauge bosons remain light. Those are the ones that we end up seeing in our low energy universe. But some of them become heavy, and some of those heavy gauge bosons can decay. And so, for example, you'll have a gauge boson that can decay to either two quarks, so you have baryon number equals plus 2/3 in that decay, or to an anti-quark and an anti-lepton. So that has baryon number minus 1/3. And so, in other words, another way to say that is that this boson mediates baryon-violating processes. You know, you can have, this says you can have two quarks come in, these reactions, this is a decay, but these reactions, the vertices that cause these reactions go both ways. So you can have the two quarks come in, turn to an X boson, and then, which then decays into quark, anti-quark and anti-lepton, in which case you've gone from an initial state with baryon number 2/3 to a final state with baryon number minus 1/3. So baryon number has not been conserved in that process. So the charge conjugate process also exists. So the antiparticle of the X, whatever particles the X decayed to, the antiparticle decays to their antiparticles. They have baryon number minus B1. And whatever particles X decayed to in the second channel, X bar, the antiparticle, will decay to the antiparticles of those. So those have baryon number minus B2. And so now an important point enters, which is that, okay, let's call the branching ratio for this process R bar, and the branching ratio for this process 1 minus R bar. So a fact that I'm just going to quote for you about quantum field theory, there's two facts that I'm going to quote. The first is that it turns out that CPT, so basically every sensible field theory ever written down satisfies CPT invariance, or under very general circumstances, a field theory will satisfy that. It follows from CPT that the total decay rate for this guy is equal to the total decay rate for this guy. But it does not follow from CPT invariance that the branching ratios here are the same as those here. Okay? So in particular, if you want the branching ratio to the top channel, branching ratio R, to be different than the branching ratio to the bottom channel, R bar, you need CP violation. Okay. C and CP violation. Okay. So taking that for granted, I just wanted to say a simple point about this. So suppose that right before these guys decay. So in the early universe, let's say initially they're in thermal equilibrium, the universe cools, the temperature at some point drops below the mass of the X boson, or the X prime boson, or the X bar, the antiparticle. So suddenly it used to be decaying and getting recreated at more or less equal rates, but now suddenly the thermal bath no longer wants to create this particle. It's gotten too heavy. The thermal bath doesn't have enough thermal energy to want to create this guy anymore. that process becomes Boltzmann suppressed. And so these guys, at some point, they freeze out, just in the way that we've discussed earlier, and they begin to float along, and they're just going to live as long as they live. They're unstable particles, and after a time one over their decay rate, they will decay. Okay, so let's suppose that right before that moment, they have equal number densities. So there's some number density of x particles, number density of x bar particles. So the total number density of x and x bars over the entropy density, you know, it has some initial value. Now let's let them all decay. You know, what is the number density afterwards? Of what is the baryon density afterwards? I should say. Well, each decay, every time one of these guys decays, it turns into, on average, it creates a baryon number. It would create a baryon number B1 if it went via this channel, which on average it does a fraction r of the time. So so that channel creates r times B1 baryon number, and then the other channel for its decay creates 1 minus r times B2, and then there's this guy. Every time it decays, it creates minus B1 times r bar, and then the second channel for the antiparticle decay creates minus B2 times 1 minus r bar. So what we have here is the baryon number. What we have now on this side is the predicted baryon number to entropy ratio after the decay. Right, we took the total number density of chi and chi bars before the decay, converted the number density into baryon number during the decay, and so we have right after the decay an expression for baryon number to entropy ratio. And so now the point is just simplify this. The only thing I want to say is if we simplify this expression, it's just this. And so what you see is that, well, this factor, in order for this to be non-zero, in order to get non-zero baryon number at the end of the day, we need this factor to be non-zero. Well, that's just the fact that the process is baryon number violating. So that's Sakharov condition one. We need this factor to be non-zero. That's just the fact that C and CP are violated. So that's Sakharov condition number two. And then Sakharov condition number three is coming from the fact that the reason that we're able to do this calculation where we just think of the particles as decaying, the x particles decay. I wasn't talking anywhere here about the inverse process where the thermal bath is colliding two particles and creating an x particle or an x bar particle. And that is because the system is out of thermal equilibrium. Once the mass of this x particle has gotten larger than the temperature of the thermal bath, then it still loves to decay into lighter particles in the thermal bath entropically. The thermal bath, it's only an extremely rare Boltzmann-suppressed fluctuation in the thermal bath ever creates a particle ends of x, a particle of mass of such a high mass. I mean that gets Boltzmann suppressed by a factor like this. It's the inverse process is exponentially rare because the thing is out of equilibrium. So that, I mean, this is just a very short taste of baryogenesis. But the point is that you now suppose you're given a model of particle physics and you want to calculate whether it gets the correct baryon asymmetry in the universe, Well, you know, you basically want to look through and see, is there any particle that has a baryon number violating decay, two channels by which it can decay that have different baryon numbers. And then once you do that, you have to calculate. You have to calculate these branching ratios you just have to calculate the sort of Feynman diagrams and the theory that give the decay rate for this process, the decay rate for this process, this one, and this one. And once you've done those four calculations, you have all the information you need to calculate this ratio. And then you ask, you know, is this thing 10 to the minus 9? If it is, you're in the money, as they say. Okay, schematically speaking. Okay, this is that's of course very quick what I just said, but I mean, I just want to at least give you a flavor. You know, that this is the sort of calculation that you should be thinking about doing if you're ever doing cosmology, if you ever want to check the cosmology of some extension of the standard model. Yep. Oh yeah, sorry. R, oops. Thank you. Okay. So having said that, I must push on to inflation. Okay. So for starters, we've said that at any point during the universe's expansion, if it's expanding with scale factor A of t, there is a natural time scale associated with the expansion at that moment, and that is just, well, if you take the Hubble rate, which is A dot over A, that has units of 1 over t, right, because there's a ddt here. So 1 over h has units of time, or in other words, the speed of light times h has units of distance. So that's a characteristic distance, and I'll set the speed of light equal to 1 from now on. So this is a characteristic distance called the Hubble radius. It's a characteristic, it's sort of the essential length scale characterizing a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe at any moment in time. It varies with time. And it's a physical length scale, and just like with any physical length scale, it's often, in cosmology, it's often convenient to convert between physical length scales and co-moving length scales. And remember, if you want to take a physical length at some moment in time and convert that to a co-moving length at that same moment in time, you divide by the scale factor at that moment in time. Right? That's the relationship between distance and co-moving distance. The distance, the physical distance between two spatial points in this metric. So at a given moment in time, this is the square of the spatial distance. So this is saying that that along each little infinitesimal element, the physical distance is a dr, and so it's a times the co-moving distance, which is just dr. So now if we integrate that up to any finite distance, the fact remains. There's this constant a of t in front. That is to say, at a fixed time, a of t is a constant. So it's just an overall multiplication factor between the two. Okay, so we take any physical distance and convert it into a co-moving distance with a factor of 1 over a. So the co-moving Hubble radius is another very useful quantity to think about. And it's just this expression divided by a. So 1 over a h. And then since h is just a dot over a, this is really just 1 over a dot. Okay? So I've gone to the trouble of introducing this quantity because I want to say that if there's one thing to remember, probably the most important thing to take away from this lecture, if there's one thing, one picture to remember for later, it is that It's the following, that if we make a drawing of time in this direction and co-moving size in this direction, let's plot the co-moving Hubble horizon in this direction. Okay, well, the idea of inflation is going to be that you want to tack on an early epoch where the universe is accelerating, a double dot is greater than zero. The universe is expanding, a dot is greater than zero, and accelerating, a double dot is greater than zero. And then that will end at a moment called reheating. And from then on, the universe will be decelerating. So it'll still be expanding, but a double dot will be negative. But if a double dot is negative, that means that a dot is getting smaller with time. So that means the co-moving horizon is getting bigger with time. So during this epoch, we expect the co-moving horizon to get bigger with time. During this early epoch, a double dot is positive. So a dot is getting bigger with time. So this ratio 1 over a dot is getting smaller with time. So if we plot, my apologies for the loud crash for anyone who's watching this on video. Okay. So during inflation, the co-moving Hubble radius will decrease, and then after inflation it will increase. And the basic point is that you can solve a bunch of problems in one fell swoop if you require the simple geometric condition that the amount of decrease that took place during this epoch is larger than the subsequent increase that took place during this epoch. Okay? In other words, if we draw the so-called co-moving Hubble radius here, the Hubble sphere, so it decreased to some minimum size at the moment of reheating, and then it increased again until today. You know, the essential geometrical requirement. I want to say the following three puzzles will all be alleviated in one fell swoop if we have this simple geometric requirement that the co-moving Hubble sphere today, the amount of co-moving volume contained in the Hubble sphere today, fits nicely within the co-moving Hubble sphere at the start of inflation. Yeah?
Why do they co-moving
radius? That's just the, you mean, so one over h, it's just, this is called the Hubble rate. It's called a rate because it has units of rate, 1 over time. One over this is called the Hubble time. That's just a name for it. It has units of time. It's a characteristic thing built from the Hubble rate. And so c times that is the co-moving Hubble distance or the co-moving Hubble radius. They call it that because if you think of a character, it is being the characteristic radius of a three-dimensional, of a spatial sphere surrounding you, then that's, for many problems in cosmology, including this one, that's a useful thing to think about. At a given time, that's often the characteristic scale that sets, you know, whether if a scale is shorter than that, one thing happens. If a scale is longer than that, another thing happens. So why is this the condition? So this is sort of the picture that you're supposed to take home, that the idea of inflation is that There are a few puzzles that people were worried about, which we've seen a couple of them and we'll review in a moment. And they could all be alleviated. All of them seemed less worrisome if you imagined that instead of the universe's history being one in which the co-moving Hubble radius was just always decreasing right from the get-go. In other words, in the previous picture was that the co-moving Hubble radius just decreased. It was radiation dominated all the way back to the Big Bang, and it just had increased forever. But if you change the picture so that the sphere initially decreased and then subsequently increased by a huge factor, as long as the subsequent increase has been limited so that today the sphere is smaller than what it was at the start of inflation, you're good to go. So let's just try to sketch quickly why that is. So let's start with the flatness puzzle. Remember, this is one of the puzzles we previously met. And the puzzle, again, is simply that if you measure the Hubble rate today, so I end at 10:10, yeah. If you measure the Hubble rate today, you measure the rate at which the universe is expanding today, you can go off and from that, convert that into units of density as follows. There's this natural quantity you can calculate that's called the critical density. And on the other hand, if you go off and try to measure the density today, you find that, to your surprise, it is precisely equal to the critical density today, plus or minus 1%. And the question is why? And what's more, so that for the past 14 billion years, the universe has been decelerating, the scale factor has been decelerating, and in a decelerating universe, if you look backwards in time, rho gets closer and closer to the critical density. So if today you're surprised by how close it is, that it's equal to within 1%, then back at Big Bang nucleosynthesis, it would have had to have been equal to a part in 10 to the 31. Or, you know, and as you go further back, the problem just gets more and more exaggerated. So the question is, why at early times, another way to say it is, why at early times was the universe so stupendously fine-tuned in its density to the critical density? And so again, if we take the Friedman equation, 8 pi g rho minus k over a squared, and we divide by h, and we rewrite this thing in the form rho divided by rho critical minus k over a squared h squared. So again, this is just the Friedman equation rewritten. We've rewritten in this form before. This is just a way to see what I'm saying, that so 1 over ah, again, that's precisely the co-moving Hubble radius here. So if the universe has been, if the co-moving Hubble radius has been growing and growing since the Big Bang, this term has just been getting bigger and bigger since the Big Bang. And yet, even today, it's less than a 1% contribution to the right-hand side of this equation. So it was very, very small or at early times. And again, the question is why. And so here you see the solution proposed by inflation is just, well, let's suppose at some initial time it was not particularly fine-tuned. Let's say it was, you know, of order one, no particularly small dimensionless number. But then if the universe accelerated, that initially order one number shrunk to some extremely, extremely, extremely tiny number. And then subsequently, it's grown again by a huge factor. But as long as the factor by which it's grown since reheating is less than the factor by which it shrunk since reheating, then we can account for the fact. You know, as long as it shrunk by a factor of, as long as the amount that it shrunk is 10 or more larger than the amount that it regrew, then we can without fine-tuning it to be very small initially, we can explain why we see it to be apparently fine-tuned to be small today, without having to, even though the universe is old today. Is that clear? Yeah? Let me talk about that in 1 minute. I mean, I was actually gonna say something about that, but if you tell me, can I talk about that in 1 minute, or is it what? Yeah, let me put off that question unless it's making it hard to understand this argument. Is that what it's doing, or? Yeah, I'll get back to that in one moment. Okay, so then there is the horizon puzzle, which we also met. This is one way to say what this puzzle is. Oh, by the way, maybe one thing I did here which is confusing is I drew these things as if they are light cones, which is not what I meant to do. This is, don't think of this as a straight 45-degree line. You know, I'm just saying that without specifying anything in detail about exactly how this thing decreased as a function of time, while the universe is accelerating, throughout this epoch where the universe is accelerating, it is decreasing, and then throughout the epoch where it is decelerating, the radius here is increasing, monotonically. But it doesn't have to be. The straight line is misleading. I just mean to say that. You can see from this argument that the basic geometric condition for resolving this puzzle is that the initial state here has to be bigger than the final state here. So what about the horizon puzzle? Well, we already saw that the horizon puzzle is basically that in a decelerating universe, if you plot conformal time on this direction and the conformal radial coordinate on this direction, chi, in a decelerating universe, eta goes to a finite time in the past. It had, the Big Bang was at a finite value of eta. And as we look back along our light cone in two different directions, as we look out on two different directions in the sky, we see two points on the CMB, which are very near that initial value of eta, so that as they would have looked back along their light cone, they would have not been able to see one another. Their light cones are disconnected. And so how did they know to have exactly the same temperature? and so again, the size, this finite radius here, this finite chi max, the maximum value of chi to which you can see, looking all the way back to the Big Bang, you know, that's equal to eta today minus eta initial, which is some integral. Remember the way we convert between normal time between conformal time and cosmic time t is with an integral like this. And we saw earlier that let's take the simple case where a of t is proportional to t to the p, so the universe is expanding as a simple power law in p, then you know, you can check that when p is greater than 1, or we did check earlier that when p is greater than 1, so in other words, the universe is accelerating, then this integral diverges. So eta initial, if we integrate all the way back to the Big Bang, eta initial diverges to minus infinity, and so the horizon problem goes away because chi max becomes infinity in that case. Whereas when p is less than 1, so the universe is decelerating, the opposite is true. We got into the trouble in the first place because we were using a decelerating expression for a of t here. So again, we're led by this puzzle again to invoke an accelerating universe to push the Big Bang down to minus infinity on this graph of eta. And then, of course, we don't really need to send the horizon off to infinity to explain the horizon problem. We don't have to send this off to infinity to explain the horizon problem. You know, we just have to extend it enough that these two points, you know, have had plenty of time to talk to one another since the Big Bang, before they emit the CMB to us. So, you know, if we extend it down to here, well, unfortunately, I've run out of blackboard space, but, you know, if we extended this thing down to the basement, you know, but just a finite distance, so that once we got down there, these two light cones would be almost overlapping. You know, they would just have a small little sliver out here and a small little sliver out here where they didn't overlap, and then there'd be no problem. These would correspond to two points that have had tons of time to interact, and so we shouldn't be surprised that they had managed to reach thermal equilibrium. So you can ask. Maybe I leave it as an exercise to ask. You know, to achieve that, how long did the period of acceleration have to go on? In other words, it didn't have to be that the universe was accelerating since the Big Bang. There just had to be prior to our current decelerating epoch, there had to be a period of accelerated expansion, some finite period of accelerated expansion. How long did that have to be? So again, you end up finding exactly the same condition, that the basic idea is that this sphere the acceleration has to have gone on long enough that when it started, this initial sphere was bigger than the co-moving Hubble sphere today. And the reason roughly is that if you take the simple case where you imagine the universe accelerated as a power law with p greater than 1 up to here, and then decelerated as a power law with p less than 1 up to here, you will find that the interpretation of the co-moving Hubble sphere at a given point is it tells you how far away a point over here can send a signal before the reheating epoch. So, or I should say, if an observer here at this moment in time sends a signal, what's the most distant co-moving observer that signal will reach before the reheating epoch arrives? It's roughly this co-moving observer here. Whereas if the observer waits until a later time and then sends out a light signal, who's the most distant co-moving observer that signal will reach before the reheating epoch, before the end of the accelerated expansion? It's this guy. So if I start far enough down that this initial radius is, you know, 10 or 100 times bigger than the final radius, observers will have been able to communicate over distances much larger than this co-moving distance. In other words, our current co-moving Hubble radius by the time that the acceleration expanded, by the time that the acceleration ended. But our current co-moving Hubble distance, my attempt to make that. This is one of these examples where the more I talked about it, the more confusing it got. Admit it. I think it was. That was literally sucking knowledge out of your brain that last few minutes. Let me leave it with where I said before, that you can see from this argument that if you put it in an accelerated expansion, that as we saw before, that sends the past horizon off to infinity, and so gets rid of this horizon problem. So again, a different argument again leads us to invoke an early period of acceleration. I leave it as an exercise to you to show to get clear in your mind why it is that that corresponds roughly to exactly the same condition, that the initial sphere here is considerably larger than the final sphere. And then finally, there is another puzzle that at least initially was a very important motivation for inflation and may still be important. Came from the so-called monopole puzzle. And so here the story was, in the mid-1970s, people had discovered the standard model of particle physics based on SU3 cross SU2 cross U1. They were very excited. They thought they had sort of glimpsed the pattern of how finding the laws of nature went. And Georgi and Glashow said, well, the natural next step is to find a single simple group that contains all of the rest of them. That would be even more unified. It would correspond to just having one gauge force instead of three. And so they found a model like that, and it was so successful in various different ways. It really, it gave a beautiful explanation for why all the anomalies canceled in the standard model, and for why the weird hypercharge assignments in the standard model were what they were. So people were just convinced that it had to be correct or at least on the right track. And you know, many people still are convinced that it is correct or had to be on the right track. The difference between now and then is that it made a prediction about proton decay it predicted that you should be able to observe proton decay, and there were a lot of experiments in the 80s to try to observe proton decay, and then they did not, and they ruled out the initial models, and that took a little bit of wind out of the sails, although then people realized that there's a way around it, by making the gut supersymmetric, you can save yourself from that problem. And again, they also, so one of the bits of evidence for grand unified theories was that if you take the three gauge couplings today, their values today, and you run them with the renormalization group up to higher scales, you find that they unify. The three lines cross at a point just as they would if these three gauge couplings were the low energy manifestation of a single gauge coupling that you've run down to where symmetry breaking took place and you ran down to low scales. So anyway, initially that looked like it worked perfectly. Then the experiments here got better. People realized that in fact the lines didn't cross properly. And again, the claim is that if you supersymmetrize the gut, that problem is fixed also. So the story was, they initially presented these very simple models that appeared to be almost certainly correct, but one bit of initial evidence for them, that these lines seemed to cross, then seemed to evaporate, and one of the main predictions, proton decay, seemed to be ruled out. But then, around the same time, people were realizing that if you add supersymmetry to this picture, that both of those problems appear to be fixed. You can explain why the proton hasn't decayed yet, and also restore the nice crossing here. And so that's sort of where things stand today. I think a lot of people still believe that grand unification is correct, but only in the context of supersymmetry. But in any case, in the late 70s, people believed that the universe was radiation dominated all the way back to the Big Bang, and they thought guts were correct. And so some grad student, John Preskill, pointed out that John Preskill is a well-known physicist, but at the time he was some grad student, and he pointed out that as the universe cools down, if the universe started at t equals infinity or t higher than the grand unified scale, which from this calculation, this was the electroweak scale, the crossing point was something like 10 to the 16 GeV. So that's called the gut scale. He argued that as the universe cooled through this transition, spontaneous symmetry breaking would have happened. So the gut above this temperature would have been would have behaved like a symmetric SU5 theory. Below this temperature, it would have undergone spontaneous symmetry breaking down to SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, the low energy standard model. And in that process, it would create monopoles, topological defects in the field configurations, basically, which for our purposes the point about them is just that they're basically like very, very, very massive point particles. So it would have created these massive things that are stable and can't decay, and their masses are comparable to this energy scale. And their masses are basically set by the gut scale. And how many of them would have happened? How many of them would you have created? Well, he argued that, roughly speaking, on causality grounds, you would create. So let's say, let's forget the lower half of the picture for a second and imagine the universe was radiation dominated all the way back, and that this was the moment of grand. This was the moment at which the temperature dropped below the grand unified scale. So he said, if you look at the co-moving Hubble horizon at that size, at that time, you would have gotten one topological defect, one monopole per co-moving horizon size at that time. But that means that in the huge co-moving horizon today, you would still, these are stable things, you would still have one per, you know, if you take this tiny little co-moving region and ask how many of them fit in the giant co-moving Hubble radius today, you get many, many, many of them. Each one contains a very massive particle. So he showed that, you know, you don't need to get all the order one factors right. All these order of magnitude estimates are okay, because you end up finding that the predicted density of the universe is so many orders of magnitude, but just contributed by these guys, is so many orders of magnitude bigger than what it is allowed to be by observations, that something was clearly wrong with the picture. Okay, so is that, did I say that in a way that got across at all? If you create one monopole of 10 to the 16 GeV per Hubble horizon at the gut scale, you can ask, and they all just hang around and are stable until today, you can ask how many of those are inside our Hubble volume today. You can work out what the density of that contribution is, and it's like orders of magnitude larger than the critical density, so much more than observations allow. Yeah. Because it's a topological defect. It's a topological defect is a configuration of the fields in a theory that can't unwind itself without. There's some, roughly speaking, there's some lump in the potential, and the fields are sort of wrapped around the potential in a way that topology prohibits them from unwrapping from that. So here in this context, the only thing that can unwrap a monopole, for example, is if it finds the sort of anti-wrapped configuration, an anti-monopole, then they can annihilate with one another, but other than that, they're stable. Yeah. I should say probably they will talk about topological defects in the subsequent the explorations in cosmology course. So if you're interested. Yeah, so the idea is that the picture was that, so in the radiation dominated picture, the universe is cooling down, and then it passes through a phase transition, at a phase transition, there is some the fields at a phase transition are correlated over some length scale, and that length scale is proportional to the temperature. So the temperature was very high. That correlation length you can show is always smaller than the remember that by the Friedman equation, H is related to the temperature. H is proportional to the energy by the Friedman equation, and the energy is proportional to T to the fourth. So you end up finding that at best the correlation length at a given time can be as large as the Hubble horizon at that time. And as a result, I should say 1 over T is the correlation length. T has units of energy. 1 over T is the correlation length, or proportional to the correlation length. And as a result, well, so he made a rough argument that if you divide up the universe into cells of size that are equal to the correlation length, and you know you have some potential, just like kind of analogous to the Higgs potential. You have some potential where the fields, roughly speaking, everywhere were sitting up at the top of their potential. And then after spontaneous symmetry breaking, they all wanted to roll down to the vacuum. But on scales larger than the correlation length, they don't know how to roll down in the same direction. So this is so here I'm being very schematic. But roughly speaking, you know, over here in this cell they'll roll down here, and in this cell they won't know that these guys have rolled down over here. They'll choose to roll down in some different direction, and so forth. So in every correlation-sized box, the field rolls down into a different direction. So it gets some sort of random distribution in field space, and you can estimate that. So roughly speaking, you can ask if you randomly redistribute the fields in every correlation-sized volume, how many times will you have randomly walked around the potential? How far out do you have to go before you find a region where the field has randomly walked around in a potential in a way that can't be unwound? And it's, you know, maybe it involves 10 or 100 of these boxes, but it's something that's not too many orders of magnitude different than an individual correlation size. I think the argument was, actually, maybe I should put the reference in the notes. I think the argument was not much more concrete than that. But the point is that the answer that you got at the end of the day was so wrong that you didn't really need to make a more precise argument than that. So in other words, people have subsequently done numerical simulations to sort of check if you randomly, you know, how many monopoles do you get if you randomly distribute the fields after spontaneous symmetry breaking. But confirmed and figured out more precisely what the expected density of them is. But the point is that very rough, you know, getting it right within a few orders of magnitude is enough in this case to see that it can't be right. So the point here is just that this same picture solves that problem because, well, if the universe was radiation dominated all the way back, so that you formed one per Hubble volume where the Hubble volume was this big, then today many of those Hubble volumes fit in the present Hubble volume, and you predict a lot of monopoles today. On the other hand, if you get one per Hubble volume at an early epoch where the Hubble volume is huge, then you know that corresponds to having less than one per co-moving Hubble volume today, which you know would explain the fact that why we have not seen any of them, let alone have them overclose the universe. Yeah. they dilute in physical space, but we're drawing this diagram in co-moving space. So they're just like other massive particles. They, roughly speaking, just sit there like co-moving observers. So their co-moving density doesn't go down, but their physical density goes down as a to the minus 3. But that's one of the reasons that it's kind of convenient for thinking about these puzzles to convert. At first, it's counterintuitive to work in terms of co-moving quantities. All of our intuition is based on, you know, physical quantities. But in fact, it's very often, you know, gives a simpler picture of things to sort of factor out the expansion of the universe by switching over to co-moving objects. Did someone? Is there a hand somewhere? No. There was, but you escaped me. There was one claim detection in the 80s, and it was never retracted, but another one was never measured.
Yeah, but if that's the case, then
that's true. I think so maybe we got lucky, and a few years after they were predicted, we managed to detect a magnetic monopole. But then we just haven't been lucky enough to see one. That is possible. Another possibility is that it was not a real detection, but an unaccounted for systematic. So it could be true. I don't mean to. The person who detected is a very well respected experimentalist. So a monopole is like a little point particle. So he's claiming it flew through his detector. Well, the Earth is moving. Yeah, the Earth is moving. The solar system is moving fast through the galaxy. The Earth. Yeah. No. If it's a random particle, you know, the Earth is moving very fast relative to the solar system is moving at something like 200 kilometers per second around the galaxy. So unless it happens to be riding along in the same direction of the Earth, it's no longer anywhere near the Earth, that particle. So you could try to detect another one, and no one has. I'm actually almost at the end of what I was going to say. Two more minutes. Okay, let's compromise. One more minute. Okay, you guys drive a very hard bargain. Just give me 30 more seconds, and just don't look at me like that anymore. So I was just going to say, oh, never mind. I'll do it at the beginning of next lecture.